I'm Evan Kleinman, and this is Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Cloned meat makes some people shriek, but it can't be dismissed so easily. Today, a scientist takes on the topic. Grilled cheese without the bread. Ugh, it's mind-blowing. I've got a recipe for you, plus other ideas for cheese. The winner of the Food & Wine Best New Chef. Pomegranate, molasses, and galangal ingredients you'll be hearing more about today. Plus, Good Food remembers the food historian who created the genre. But of course, first, let's go to the farmers markets to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. When you look at the farmers' tables now, you'll notice some wonderful flat beans. These are not the normal Blue Lake green beans. These are a flat bean. They're called Romano, and they come in a green or a yellow. It looks a little tough. It looks like it's going to be a tough bean, but I got to tell you, that is one of my favorite beans. And the key to having a really good Romano bean is not to overcook it. So luckily, we have an excellent chef here with us today to help us through this process of how to cook these Romano beans to perfection. It's Evan Kleinman.
Hi.
And you're here, and boy, these beans are so good. I saw you shaking your head, don't overcook them.
No. Actually, my recipe is that you cook them to death.
Oh, well, then do tell. Do tell. Maybe I'll have to change.
Every time I see these flat beans, I get very excited because it means I can make the really well-known, anybody who's been to Greece has eaten these very, very long-cooked Greek beans. It comes from this family of olive oil-braised vegetables. And so what I like to do is I just take the Romano beans, I snap off the stem end, I throw them in a pot with an onion, very finely minced, a cup of any kind of tomato sauce that you like, already prepared tomato sauce, maybe a pinch of sugar, salt to taste, and then you mix it up completely with the beans. Then you add, this is the scary part, 1/4 inch in your pot. I would add 1/2 inch because I have no fear of oil. But for those who have fear of oil, you add 1/4 inch and the same amount of water. So what I would do, the real way of doing it, is like 1/2 inch to 1 inch of oil, the same amount of water. Then you take parchment paper. This is a key part of the process for me. And you put it directly on top of the beans. You cover them with a lid, and then you bring it to a boil, and then you turn it down and let it simmer. And you let it simmer for, are you ready?
I'm holding on.
At least 2 hours.
Oh, my goodness.
What happens is all the fibers in the bean break down completely. They braise in the oil, and they become this incredible, luscious, sexy, beany thing that you end up eating at room temperature. And my favorite way is to eat them at room temperature with maybe a little bit of great French feta on the side, so you get the smooth, succulent, luscious, oily, tomatoey bean and that sharpness of the cheese, and have a little bread to get all those delicious
That sounds so good. Now, is there a lot of oil left over? Is it all absorbed? When you put this on your plate, are you like in a lake of oil?
No, you're just in a beautiful... No, what happens is it all becomes magically into a beautiful sauce. Mm. The water helps the beans break down quickly, and then the moisture that's inside the beans, the oil and the tomato sauce just all work together to create this beautiful, luscious sauce. And they have a nice little sheen at the end. Fabulous. People go crazy when I make it, and they love to eat it. And then when I give them the recipe, the look on their face is one of horror.
Shock. Did I just eat that? That is so, you know, maybe the slow cooking is what keeps their integrity. Now, if we don't have a nice jar of tomato sauce lying around, is just a can of roasted tomatoes okay to put in there? Or?
Yeah, you could use a fresh tomato, too.
Oh.
And I would grate them, actually.
Oh.
Grate the tomatoes.
Mm-hmm. And skin them?
Into it. Well, you know, there's this trick where if you cut the tomato in half and use a box grater and you put the cut half against the teardrop grates and you grate it, you'll have this beautiful grated flesh, and at the end in your hand, you'll have the peel.
Little tomato skin on your hand. Wow, that's great.
Yes, so you'll leave the peel behind. So much easier than taking out the pan and boiling the water.
That is such a good idea. Oh, great, Evan. Well, these beans are wonderful. They're at several stands. Be sure to check them out, and not to be confused with the yellow wax beans, which are also wonderful, the round beans. But these Romano beans really should be tasted. They're just so great, and they're in season now, and they'll be around probably until it gets too hot. And Evan, with all these great cooking tips, you must be offering classes. Is there not one coming up soon?
Yeah, I have a couple actually coming up on June 3rd, which is a Sunday, at Angeli. I'm going to be doing a class from Trader Joe's. It's very sort of not farmer's market, but it is a reality check, and all of us do have a few days in the week where we're hysterical. And rather than go through the drive-thru or get something at the supermarket, I've really sort of reinvigorated my own home cooking by teaching myself some really easy, simple things to do that taste delicious, made with stuff that is real food, but packaged in a way that makes it very, very convenient.
Sounds great. All right, Evan, thank you so much. So great to see you here. And I am going to try that Romano. I am not afraid of olive oil. I am going to try that recipe.
Oh, definitely do.
Yeah, I will. We're visiting now with a longtime market participant, Elmer Lehman, who comes down from Fresno. And Elmer is one of the farmers who was here the day the market opened in 1981. And Elmer, you've come down today with just peaches. Every farmer's so excited about their peaches. Tell us what kind of peach you have and try to describe it for us, would you?
It's a cream cress. It's an early peach, and it's nice and sweet, and it has a nice color.
So it's a classic kind of a yellowy red. It's not all red. It's got that beautiful peach color, and it has that little pointy tip on the bottom.
And it does have a little tip on it.
And I understand that those little tips would make it not suitable for commercial growing because they bruise very easily. So these aren't that easy to find anywhere else, right?
No, because the bigger the point, the more damage. So.
All right. Well, Elmer, it's always so much fun to talk to you, see your beautiful fruit. I know you're very proud of it, and it looks really nice. And how much are those a pound?
$2.50 a pound.
$2.50 a pound.
And pre-ripe, picked yesterday.
Picked by you.
By me and my workers.
You and your workers. Right. Okay. All right, Elmer. Well,
okay.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, too.
That was Elmer Lehman, and he comes down from Fresno. He is a longtime farmer here at the market, and he's been farming all his life. And we love it when Elmer comes back. This is his first day back at the Wednesday market, and he'll be here all the way through grape season. Be sure to join us next Wednesday, May 30th, at the Farmers Market. We are so happy to be hosting a cooking demonstration with Alain Giraud. He is the Four Stars private cuisine chef. He's also planning on opening a French brasserie in Santa Monica on Santa Monica Boulevard, right next to the promenade. And Chef Giraud will be at the market on Wednesday, cooking something fresh from the market and selling small plates as samples. You can come by, meet the chef, taste his wonderful food, and ask him when his brasserie is going to open. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Got kitchen waste? Why not compost it? I've got all you need to know about composting in my latest video podcast. You can find it at kcrw.com/goodfood or on iTunes. Check out the worms. Okay, now back to eating food. Hold the worms. If you love grilled cheese like I do, you've got to try it without the bread. Not just any cheese will work, so I've got the goods when Good Food returns. Serve this at a party and your guests will never forget you. That's coming up next. The artisanal, handmade, unique little ambassadors from pockets of culinary culture here in the U.S. and abroad. We know we love this stuff, but what can we do with it besides make nice little wedges or awesome quesadillas? To aid us on the way to true cheese literacy is Melody Dosh of the Artisan Cheese Gallery in Studio City. So, Melody, at the KCRW Sounds Eclectic concert, you were part of the VIP victuals, and you were making some really amazing stuff. Describe what you were doing.
We were using a cheese called halloumi, which originally comes from the island of Cyprus, which is off of Greece. And it's spelled H-A-L-L-O-U-M-I for anybody who wants to know. It's grilled cheese, basically. And halloumi it's made like you make a fresh mozzarella. So you take the curds, after you mold it, you cook them. And what happens is when you cook it, it's like kneading bread. It lengthens the protein chains in the cheese. So you get this nice, dense cheese that you can then put on. We put it on panini grills and grill it. You can put it on your barbecue.
Without any bread.
Without any bread, nothing. Because the protein chains have gotten longer from the kneading of the cheese, it doesn't fall apart. It holds its shape and it gets crunchy on the outside and it's like no other cheese in the world. It's just amazing. It's salty cheese. That's part of the whole process, but it's unbelievably delicious.
So when you were serving it, were you just serving it plain like that, or did it have a little bit of condiment on it?
Traditionally, if you get the cheese from Cyprus, the traditional unpasteurized version, when they knead the curds, they knead mint into the cheese, so it'll have little green flecks in it. The cheese that we had didn't have the mint in it. So we topped it with lemon juice, chopped mint, and then a little 25-year-old balsamic vinegar.
Oh, just a little 25-year-old balsamic vinegar.
We spare no expense for you guys.
And I should say, these are the moments to take out those condiments that you've been saving forever, that you bought on a trip to some far place, and you're afraid to use it up.
Absolutely. We had chutneys out, a plum chutney and a tomato chutney. You can put anything on halloumi. It's fabulous. It's one of those, you know, all-purpose foods. It travels anywhere. You can put anything on it. You can eat it with meat. In Cyprus, they eat it with fresh fruit. They don't grill it. They just slice it and eat it with watermelon. That's a good breakfast, I guess, in Cyprus.
Give us another cheese recipe.
I'll give you one that I think is really easy. It's a cheese kebab. So you take the halloumi, you cut it into cubes, and you marinate it like you would fish or chicken. You can use lime juice, olive oil, little parsley, little garlic, little pepper. Marinate the cheese for about half an hour, and then stick it on a skewer with peppers and onions and mushrooms. Throw it on the grill. You can put a little more marinade on it when you're grilling it, and let it get dark and charred and crunchy and take it off, and it's really easy, really yummy. You can also do something if you wanted to make a couscous salad. You can take the halloumi. If you don't want to grill it, you can put it in a skillet and just brown it in the skillet, get it nice and crunchy again, make some couscous, take a little yogurt, mix a little cumin in with the yogurt, a little parsley, get some marinated artichoke hearts, some chickpeas and the marinated artichokes, and then some red peppers. Mix it all together, drizzle on the yogurt, and that's a really easy, yummy salad.
Any other ideas?
Yeah, I have a recipe here that is, it's a shrimp recipe. And basically, you make a tomato sauce, and this tomato sauce is wonderful because it's got a little bit of cinnamon in it, so it's a little exotic. And then you cook the shrimp separate from the tomato sauce. You put those on the grill, and you grill the halloumi. And after you've made this tomato sauce, which takes about 20 minutes, you put the shrimp down, you put a layer of this tomato sauce, sprinkle a little cinnamon in addition to the tomato sauce, put the halloumi on, another layer of the tomato sauce, and you've got dinner. And it's great.
Wow, that sounds wonderful. It's like an eggplant parmesan made out of cheese.
Yes, exactly.
Well, thank you so much, Melody.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Artisan Cheese Gallery is Melody Dosh's shop. It's located in Studio City. The recipes that Melody mentioned are all available on our website at kcrw.com/goodfood. The whole notion of artisan products is that they follow a food-making tradition when foods were made by hand. The way we know about the old days of food is through the hard work of food historians. But food historians didn't really exist before the work of Karen Hess. We lost Karen this past week. More about her own history next when Good Food continues. Every once in a while, a person with quiet authority comes along and changes everything. Karen Hess, culinary historian, did just that. She recently died at the age of 88, but in the 70s, her book, The Taste of America, was one of the seminal books for me, for many others, that proved that cuisine could be worthy of historical and sociological study. I've asked famed book curator Barbara Haber, late of the Schlesinger Library Collections at Radcliffe, and author of From Hardtack to Home Fries, to share some thoughts and memories of Ms. Hess. Tell us a little bit about Karen. What was her background? Was she a chef?
No, she really wasn't. She was what we would call today an independent scholar. She was doing primary research in American food history at a time when no one else really, or very few people, were taking it as seriously as Karen was. She is someone who rolled up her sleeves and understood that cookbooks were a major source for understanding American food ways and the culture around food.
The Taste of America, her book that came out in the 80s, which she wrote with her husband. How can you describe to someone today what the Taste of America meant when it first came out?
They were setting very, very high standards. From colonial times on, for example, people were using more baking powder and baking soda in baked goods. Quality of flour was declining with industrialization. She saw all these signs as the inevitable approach of junk food. And it was a kind of siren call to let people know that we could do something about it, that Americans, you know, had good food products, good food stuffs around, and that we shouldn't let other people decide what the state of American food is going to be all about. Apart from the Taste of America, people doing American food history really revere her for her work on the Martha Washington cookbook and the book I use all the time, which is the Virginia Housewife, Mary Randolph's cookbook.
Now, why were these so important? The work she did on Martha Washington's cookbooks and diaries, the culinary ephemera that she found, what was so important in those books?
Karen was really interested in the early American food history, and you can't get much earlier than what we think of as the Martha Washington cookbook. What that was, as you know, was several what we call manuscript cookbooks. That is, you know, those handwritten recipes that families tend to write down and collect. And several of those kinds of volumes had wound up in Martha Washington's possession. But that what they represent is what British food had been like in the 16th and 17th century, which was one of the origins of American cookery, of Virginia cookery in particular, where, of course, the Washingtons lived. And by examining in very careful detail with lots of footnotes and glosses, Karen was able to notice when things came into the cooking vernacular, what things were brought over from England, what the adaptation was like to American products. Corn would be a good example of how people raised with oats and wheat learned to use corn and make interesting and very palatable and good breads using corn instead of the grains that they were accustomed to. And these are the kinds of things that she's noticing. And with very good scholarship, she is making the case for what people were eating when, what the influences were, and what the products really were like.
So before her, was there anyone at all who took these kinds of homemade cookbooks seriously as a portal into the wider world of history?
Not so much in America is what I would say. She was a purist, all right, and felt that America had wonderful food products and one should leave them alone. With the things that we're hearing today, we should eat things that are grown regionally. We should know how to recognize good quality foods and protect those standards. And I think that any kind of commercialization, processing of those kinds of things, she always would see as taking something away from something that used to have been better. I would have loved talking to her about the Food Network. Never had the chance to do that.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome.
Barbara Haber is a noted food historian located in Massachusetts. She's also the author of From Hardtack to Home Fries, An Uncommon History of American Cooks and Meals. We've been talking about Karen Hess, food historian, who recently passed away. Speaking of history, they sure didn't have cloning in the old days. Or did they? Farmers and growers have been messing around with genetics since the beginning of time. Now we're in an age where the process can take weeks compared to generations. So is it harmful? Cloned meat, the scientific view. That's next when Good Food continues. There's a new conversation happening at the edge of food technology. Cloned beef is now a reality, and it looks like approval for the consumption of meat from these animals will happen. I'm interested in hearing from as many parts of this conversation as possible, so my next guest is Dr. Allison Van Inenam. She's an animal geneticist from UC Davis. Hi, Allison. How are you?
Very well, thank you.
If you could describe to us what a cloned animal is, and then also if you could describe what a transgenic animal is.
Okay, so those are two very different types of animals. And basically, a cloned animal is genetically identical to the founder animal that it was derived from. And in that sense, if you think about identical twins, they're clones of each other also. That is, that they're genetically identical to each other. They just happen to be derived from an egg that's split during the development process. The clones that we've been talking a lot about recently and that the FDA ruling is about is when you actually take an adult cell and take the nuclear or the genetic material out of that adult cell and then put that into an empty egg and basically create an embryo and therefore a fetus and an offspring from that. And that gives you the ability to create genetically identical copies of the animal that you had the original adult tissue from.
And why would you want to do that?
That type of cloning, that was really what Dolly was all about.
Dolly the sheep.
Dolly the sheep, who was created in 1996-97, her publication came out, created a great deal of excitement. And the reason that scientists were actually working to clone sheep in this particular case was really not to create more sheep for agricultural applications or for food applications, but to actually enable them to produce an animal from cells that were grown in a culture dish, in this case mammary gland in the case of Dolly, and therefore be able to genetically modify that cell to enable it to produce maybe a therapeutic protein that would be expressed in the animal that was cloned from that cell, and that animal would then be able to produce, for example, therapeutic proteins in their milk. And at the current time, the way that that's done is using cell culture dishes of, believe it or not, Chinese hamster ovary cells.
So in a way, you're turning to cows because the mammary production facility, as it were, is so much larger than that of a hamster.
Right. And so, of course, you know, why would you use cows for this type of thing? Well, there's a number of reasons why you would use a cow, and that is that they're large animals. And so they make large amounts of milk if you're producing it in the milk, or you can also produce it in the plasma of the blood. And an average cow has about 2.5 pounds of antibodies in its blood just because of its size. And so actually one company has used the techniques of cloning in combination with transgenics. And just to go to what transgenics is, that's when you add a gene. So that's cloning makes an identical copy. Transgenic, you add a new piece of DNA or a new gene and make a new protein. So that's the fundamental difference.
I know that you work on agricultural applications of cloning. So many of us that are sort of aficionados of the more natural movements sort of wonder why do we need to clone animals for the food supply? What benefit is that?
Well, so I guess we need to talk about what is cloning being used for in the agricultural sector. And basically, I want to make clear that this is not a technique that's going to have wide application in agriculture because it's an expensive technique in the vicinity of $15,000 to $20,000 per animal. And most animals aren't worth that much in the agricultural setting. So the ones that are worth that much tend to be the very elite breeding stock. For example, bulls that are used in dairy production, the very elite bulls will have done progeny tests whereby their semen is collected and through artificial insemination, they will have their production tested in thousands of daughters throughout the country. And if all of those daughters perform well, then that bull is seen to have very good genetic merit. And he goes to become a very valuable bull because you've got a lot of resources invested in doing this genetic proof, it's called, or kind of showing that he's really got the goods to make good progeny. And so those animals can be worth millions of dollars. And so if, for example, there's a bull that's in such high demand that he cannot actually supply enough semen for the AI demand, if you were to clone him, his clone would produce exactly the same genetic semen as what that very valuable bull does. And so it may be done for that purpose or as a genetic insurance policy.
What about the concern that some people might have about in using sperm of one steer, one bull, in such a huge way, really cuts down on the whole biodiversity?
Right. And I think that you bring up a valid point, and there is some concerns about the level of diversity that exists currently in our domestic livestock. However, I think if you look at the level of diversity, what's caused a lot of that to be removed is the fact that we've got these genetic proofs that show the very good animals, and there does tend to be a lot of selection on the traits that are going to be the most beneficial for the producer. And so we've already got a narrowing of the genetic diversity that goes on partly as a result, quite frankly, of artificial insemination, which, I mean, you've already got that, you know, one animal getting used on thousands and thousands and thousands of females. Cloning, you know, would add a small amount to that, but in a more general sense, if you're going to say cloning does that in and of itself, you're putting a lot of other factors that are contributing to the reduced genetic diversity on the back of one technology without kind of acknowledging the fact that there's many other factors that are also creating that.
So interesting talking to you, and I really look forward to having future conversations with you more about transgenics and other things that are happening in the laboratory that we might see reflected on the table one day. Thank you,
Evan. You're very welcome, Evan.
That was Dr. Allison Van Inenum. She's an animal geneticist from UC Davis. We've been talking about some of the issues involved in cloning. Have you noticed you've been sneezing a lot lately? I'll tell you how that ubiquitous foe, global warming, might be causing allergy sufferers to suffer even more. Plus, how warm oceans make a nice home for bacteria. That's when Good Food returns on KCRW and KCRW.com. As the idea of global warming becomes more acceptable to even the most closed of minds, more elements of its dangers become apparent. But there's a subplot to global warming that hasn't been much discussed in public forums until now. Jari Chung, staff science writer for the Los Angeles Times, recently wrote an article in which she describes how, quote, "the spread of human disease has become one of the most worrisome subplots in the story of global warming." Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about first the oceans and seafood.
Mm-hmm.
I understand that oysters are starting to have a type of bacteria count and a kind of bacteria that hasn't been seen in northern waters before.
Yes, this is pretty surprising for all the people that I talk to. There's a bacterium known as Vibrio parahemolyticus, and it's pretty common in warmer waters like the Gulf of Mexico, and it's been found basically as far north as British Columbia. But, you know, Alaska, which is, you know, 600-something miles above that, was just thought to be too cold to have this bacteria. In 2004, there was this big outbreak. I think it was among about 80 people of food poisoning. And they found out that all these people, some of whom had been on cruise ships, had eaten these oysters raw. And so they thought, oh, okay, well, let's go back and see what happened in these oysters. And they found a lot of this bacteria there.
And so what are the fishermen doing to be able to keep their crops, their oysters, palatable, safe?
Well, you know, there was a lot of concern at first. I talked to the head of the Shellfish Growers Association, and he was saying that, you know, summer is a really big time for Alaska oysters because oysters from other areas, which are warmer, are banned. You know, you can't eat them from other places during the summer. And so, you know, for Alaska, that's great. So they were really worried at first because they weren't sure what they could do to get rid of this bacteria. I mean, it was a naturally growing thing. You know, their waters are pretty pristine and really far away from, you know, human habitation. So it wasn't pollution. It wasn't anything like that. So they had to figure out a way to get around it. And they realized, well, if you just drop your oysters below a level that they call the thermocline in the waters, which is basically a sort of sudden jump from warm waters to cold waters, they could basically just leave their oysters down there for, you know, a little over a week, and the bacteria would just kind of slowly disappear. And then the oysters would be fine.
Wow. It's great that they found a solution. What about fellow allergy sufferers, which of course I am one.
Yeah.
I understand that there's an impact of increased CO2 levels on ragweed.
Yeah. You know, I was talking to a researcher at the USDA labs in Beltsville, Maryland, and he, too, is an allergy sufferer. So, you know, this was a subject dear to him. What he told me was that in our current age, the carbon dioxide levels are actually kind of low, you know, in the history of plants. And so in some ways, these plants are just starved, you know. So once you start increasing carbon dioxide, that's their food, and they start, you know, gobbling the carbon dioxide down like hungry teenagers. So plants of all kind are going to probably grow a lot better, you know, as carbon dioxide levels increase. And, you know, one thing that he was particularly concerned about was ragweed, because it's a pretty bad and noxious allergen. and he created these metal boxes, which he called, you know, environmental growth chambers, I think, and tested different levels of carbon dioxide. And he found that increasing the carbon dioxide levels just dramatically increased the amount of allergens that these plants produced.
Wow. It's like hard to avoid. Also, let's talk a little bit about the cereal crops.
Okay.
What are the effects of global warming on the cereal crops, which we traditionally think of as wheat, rice? Mm.
Well, you know, the agriculture guy that I talked to, Lou Ziska, from the USDA, he's done a lot of research on this, and he's actually partnered with some people from Texas and a rice institute in the Philippines, because he wants to know what kind of rice is going to grow best under the new carbon dioxide regime. And, you know, he has the same, you know, aluminum boxes set up where he's dialed in different carbon dioxide levels. And he's found that with wheat and with rice, you know, the current crops that we have may not be the ones that grow the best under, you know, the new levels of carbon dioxide. So he's doing some experimentation to see how we can sort of make the carbon dioxide change work for us to produce more food and to produce better food.
That was Jahri Chung. She's staff science writer for the Los Angeles Times. She's been doing an article on global warming and food-related illnesses. All this talk about global warming and manipulation of our food supply is enough to just make you want to bury your head in the sand. But I say pick your head up and get a handle on what you can have some control over. Your kitchen is a great place to start. Next, a celebration of food from a man who calls himself the Breakaway Cook. You'll be the first to know how to use galangal and pomegranate molasses at home. That's in 1 minute, right here on Good Food. Home cook jazz up their old favorites. Eric Gower suggests we think just a little outside the box and try some global flavor blasts.
Thanks to internet shopping and the prevalence of ethnic markets, some of these ingredients are more readily available than one would imagine, and all we have to do is just take the bold leap and try them. Hi, Eric.
Hi, Evan. So great to be back.
So how do you think of these blasts? Is it a way of getting a high note or a sourness to recipes? I know cooks, you know, professional chefs, we're always trying to find the next new sour thing.
Yes. Yes. It's really a way of adding intensity to food. If you think about how a lot of these global flavor blasts are made, they tend to be very labor-intensive things like miso. You know, you take a bunch of soybeans and you ferment it in a special enzyme and you wait, you know, 6 months to 3 years and whammo, you've got this amazing stuff that's sort of percolated for a long time.
Okay, I'm going to throw out an ingredient and then you tell us what we can do with it.
Okay.
Galangal. What is it, first of all?
Okay, galangal is a rhizome, i.e. a root, sort of like ginger. It's in the ginger family. It's very prevalent in Southeast Asian cooking, and I think pretty much all of your listeners are familiar with it in Thai soups. Sometimes you get a coin of very fragrant, sort of florally ginger that is so tough you can't actually eat it. That, to me, is not a great use of galangal because there's kind of extra work involved. You know, a lot of people don't know that you can't eat it, so you take a bite and you get this sort of unpleasant experience. But if you flavor stuff with galangal and then you remove it, it becomes an unbelievable ingredient. And surprisingly, it makes a delicious ice cream if you combine it with brown sugar and a regular custard ice cream base.
So what do you do? Do you grate it?
No, you could just chop it up roughly and steep it in some cream. And when, you know, after a few minutes of steeping really is all it needs, you simply strain it out and proceed with making your ice cream.
Okay, another one. And this really is my favorite. I could just drink jars and jars of it. And that's pomegranate molasses.
Oh, I know. I'm almost like, you know, an addict straight from the jar.
It makes the best vodka drinks, I'll tell you.
Oh, is that right? I've never gone that route. One of my favorite things to do with pomegranate molasses is, and again, this is like the simpler the better here. You know, we're trying to really keep a minimalist approach with this breakaway cooking. But if you rub a really nice piece of salmon, if you can get a locally caught, ideally, you know, wild salmon, rub it with a little bit of olive oil, and then just take like a teaspoon of pomegranate molasses and just kind of spoon it on. And what happens is you'll get this sort of dark reddish, almost purplish glaze that infiltrates the salmon. And then you bake it at a pretty high temperature and it gets this sort of a little bit sweet, a little bit sour, kind of treacly glaze. And it's just marvelous. And then you top that off with some good salt, like some citrus salt or something like that, and some good pepper. And you'll never look at salmon the same.
Oh, it's so good. I love it also on roast chicken.
Oh, it's the best on roast chicken. All you have to do is separate the skin of the chicken a little bit with your fingers the way you do, you know, if you'd put butter and herbs or something like that. But instead of that, just, again, spoon a little pomegranate molasses in and kind of spread it around. And it's the same thing happens to chicken. You get this dark, fruity, little bit sour, piquant glaze that it's marvelous.
Okay, now what about umeboshi?
Umeboshi. Umeboshi are pickled plums. They're very popular in Japan as a kind of end of a meal. A lot of my Japanese friends always say if they haven't had an umeboshi at the end of a meal, they somehow don't feel it's been a complete meal. And it's kind of used as a digestive. And it's very, very tart. It's also salty, and it's also a little bit sweet all at the same time. So it's this incredible flavor bomb. And I do all kinds of things with it. I like to make a kind of rice porridge with it that's really, really good. I like to slice it up and put it on grilled scallops. They're really, somehow the flavor of the umeboshi with the sweetness of the scallops just goes really well. And sometimes I'll make a kind of marinade with it. You just throw a couple of them in the blender. They do have pits, so you have to pit them first and throw a few in the blender with some olive oil and an egg is what I do. And it turns this wonderful shade of sort of purplish pink, and you marinate the scallops in that. So they really, if you marinate them overnight, they really get infused with flavor. And then the next day you sort of brush it off, and then I'll dust it with something, either, you know, either panko or one of my favorites, if you grind up pink lentils and sprinkle those over the top of the scallops, and then heat up a pan over high heat with a little bit of olive oil and kind of like pan fry that. Both sides get very crispy from the pulverized pink lentils, and inside is this really piquant, you know, scallop flavor blast.
That's like genius. I have never thought about doing that, grinding up pink lentils.
As a crust. And you can do the same thing. There's a wonderful thing you can do with it, too. It's kind of like the tofu version of that dish that I just described is one of my favorite recipes in the new book. What you do is you take a tub of medium to soft tofu and add an egg and then add a whole big glop of, well, you could either do it with umeboshi or pomegranate molasses or tamarind, okay? And mix that together with the tofu just with a spoon, and you'll get this wonderful sort of colored tofu. And then I put that into a clay pot and I bake it in the oven for, I don't know, 20 minutes in a relatively hot oven, like 400. And then toward the end, I'll put on more crushed pink lentils over the top of that, spray it with a little olive oil, and suddenly this insanely great baked tofu now has a really crispy top to it. And over that top, I'll add a couple of chives or, you know, I mean, some parsley or whatever fresh herb you have. Actually, Thai basil works really well. And you take it out of the clay pot and just, or you can just serve it in the clay pot at the table, family style, and people just spoon it out. And that combination of the crispy top and the really fruity tofu with lots of good salt in there, of course, is a whole new way to think about tofu.
Wow. Thank you so much, Eric.
Oh, thank you, Evan.
Eric Gower is the Breakaway Cook. He's got a great column on Yahoo. I've got the link to it and the info we talked about on our site at kcrw.com/goodfood. Speaking of cooks, I wonder if your personality changes after being named Best New Chef by Food & Wine magazine. I'm about to find out. That's coming up on Good Food. Last year, we met Gavin Kaysen, chef at El Bizcocho, the restaurant in the Rancho Bernardo Inn just north of San Diego. He had just won the American finals of the Bocuse d'Or competition, which gave him the right to represent the U.S. against 23 other countries in this most prestigious world chef competition that takes place in Lyon, France. He was also, coincidentally or maybe not, also recently named one of Food & Wine's magazine's Best New Chefs for 2007. What makes these accomplishments even more impressive is that Gavin is just 27 years old. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
I have been waiting for a year to have this conversation with you, because our last conversation, you were talking about all the training you were going through for the Bocuse d'Or, mm-hmm. how difficult it was, the type of plating you had to do, and now you've actually experienced it.
Yeah. For 8 months, we spent every Tuesday and Sunday training. But beyond that, we learned how to balance the training of our competition with running a restaurant, was still doing PR events and appearances and things like that. And it's like it was a very stressful time, of course, but I think it helped me grow a lot as a culinarian and more as a manager to my cooks that work with me every day.
You mentioned to me before we started talking on the air that once you got to France, you realized that a lot of the other people competing were not working a job.
Yeah, a lot of them spent, you know, 18 to 22 months just training and quit their job or, you know, made a new sort of title for themselves so they didn't actually have to necessarily work. We didn't have that luxury. But, you know, it's also one of those things that you have to realize that these guys are training 6 to 8 hours every single day for this competition. Now, truthfully, if we would have won the Bocuse d'Or in France and come back to America, would it have held the same exact, you know, prestigious feeling that it does when you win it in Europe? Obviously, we don't know yet, so we'll have to wait and see.
What number did you come in?
14th in the world.
And who won?
France.
They don't always win, though.
No. I mean, they've won 7 out of 11 times they've won. So, I mean, they obviously have a formula that works.
They have an in.
Yeah, they know somebody.
So once you were there, Was the experience of being there the same as training, or was the level of pressure and chaos so kicked up that it was another frame of reference completely?
You know, I think my wife actually said it perfect. She looked at me about a month and a half before the competition, and she said, "You are emotionally shut off." And she was completely right. I think probably like a month and a half to 2 months before the competition, my assistant and I just emotionally turned ourselves off to everything around us. So the pressure of it was huge. We all got sick like 2 weeks before the competition, I think, because of that. But once we were actually competing, we didn't feel it. I mean, there was a point in time where Paul Bocuse was screaming my name to say hello to me, and I was so tuned out of everything else, I didn't even hear him until I looked over the third time thinking, who keeps yelling my name? And then I look over and it's Monsieur Bocuse. So, of course, I stopped what I'm doing.
So even though you didn't win the gold, are there any particular experiences that were sort of funny or strange that you had while you were there?
Yeah, of course. You know, I mean, we tried to eliminate every risk by buying the oven that we were going to compete with, to restaging our kitchen in San Diego, like how it was going to be in France. We shipped over carpets from San Diego to France so we could put carpet all over our kitchen so that way we wouldn't have to think about walking.
But
we
didn't. When you mean think about walking in terms of slipping.
Right, because the way that the kitchens were all set up, they had like a rubber floor. And when people would be opening and closing the door, it was snowing outside. So the snow would come in and get on the floor and it would make it very wet. We didn't want to deal with that. So we brought carpets. Now, one thing we didn't plan on was they give us a second apprentice, and we used him as a dishwasher the whole time. And I went to go put out the chicken platter, and everything was out. And then all of a sudden, I turned to go put the last two garnishes on the platter, and I couldn't find them. And I looked at the dishwasher, this young French kid, and I said, "Where's my barbecue chicken wings?" And he said, "I ate them." So he ate the last two chicken wings. We couldn't put it out. We put out everything else, but we didn't have the last two garnishes. So I walked up to Regis Marcon, who's the president of the jury, and I told him about it, and he said, "Don't worry, we'll take care of it." So,
did you want to throttle the kid?
Yeah, but I had 1,500 international media staring at me. I figured I had two choices. I could walk away or knock him out. I walked away.
When you come back to your own restaurant after this whole thing, and you're not preparing for competition, talk a little bit about that, how food prepared for competition is completely different than food that you sit down and eat in a restaurant.
Yeah, I mean, competition food, you basically have, if you build a garnish, for example, and the garnish will be four bites, you have to make that garnish perfect in one bite, which means that the judge has to get the flavor, the texture, the seasoning, and the hot-cold effect all in one bite. Whereas when you're sitting down to have a dinner, you have numerous times that they go back to that plate and the guest will experiment with trying out different things on the plate. And maybe, you know, they'll mix in this little potato with the fish or whatever. And that gives them a different texture.
So in the process of doing all this and having the opportunity to sort of hobnob with chefs all over the world and the kind of preparation you do for the competition, do you kind of look at dining trends in a different way? What dining trends do you think are coming up on the horizon?
I think from just talking with all the other chefs and seeing it, I think I see two things that are consistent. One is smaller plates, meaning just smaller, not like tapas, meaning that, but more along the lines of smaller portioned food. Because to be honest, if you send out something that's too big, by the fifth, sixth, or seventh bite, it's become bland and it's the same taste over and over again. I also see a huge growing trend in smaller restaurants, you know, 40-seat restaurants, 35-seat restaurants. I mean, if you take a look at the chefs, the nine other chefs that I'm on the cover of Food & Wine with in July, there's only two of us that actually hold a restaurant that has more than 80 seats.
But the financial paradigm for making it with a smaller seat house is so much more difficult.
Yeah, I think you're right. But I think what chefs are looking at it as is an opportunity for them to showcase a lot more of what's local for them. And I mean, we, you know, obviously at El Bizcocho, we do that. We have a farmer that will come in and say, you know, "What do you want me to plant for you?" And there's a section in his farm that says El Bizcocho at the Rancho Bernardo Inn, don't mess with it. You know, it's like, and that's our food. So I see that as a not just a growing trend, but a trend that's continuing throughout and staying very strong in the industry, which is great.
Well, Gavin, it is always such a pleasure to talk with you. You're so articulate about the whole business. Thank you so much. We'll have
to check in
with you in another year and see what's on your plate.
Absolutely. Thanks again.
El Bizcocho at the Rancho Bernardo Inn in San Diego is Gavin Kaysen's restaurant. He recently won Best New Chef from Food & Wine magazine. Gavin Kaysen's a very nice person, but I'm not sure who would say that of my next guest. He was known as the enfant terrible of the British restaurant scene, but his creativity did allow British food to rise above its horrible reputation. I'll be right back with Marco Pierre White. That's when Good Food returns. Kitchen Bad Boys, they now are famous. Gordon Ramsay, Mario Batali, Anthony Bourdain. But the original, the prototype, was Marco Pierre White, the most decorated chef in English history and the youngest chef ever to win 3 Michelin stars. He's universally regarded as the man who brought British cuisine into the world of haute. But what a fascinating personality. Famous perfectionist, expecting nearly as much from customers as from his cooks, famous temper, famous womanizer, and mentor to many. His latest book on this side of the pond is The Devil in the Kitchen. Welcome, Chef.
Hi.
You once said that if you're not extreme, then people will take shortcuts because they don't fear you, speaking about running a kitchen and a restaurant. Do you still feel that way?
Well, I think if you allow people to take shortcuts, they will, because majority of people are naturally lazy. So I think you have to be extreme in every aspect of running a kitchen. You have to keep them concentrated. You have to let them know that they can't take those shortcuts.
The environment of a restaurant involves so many details, so many people involved to try and create a train sort of going down the same track. This idea of being such a perfectionist, as you were famous for being, do you think it's just endemic to the task, or do you think you brought a little something personal to it?
I've never been one of those chefs who cooked by numbers. And so the difficulty for any chef is to transport what are within his hands across a team of 20, 25 chefs. And that's where the difficulty comes in. So therefore, when you're writing your menus, when you're creating your food, when you're designing your food, you have to think that you've got 25 chefs in your kitchen, you've got to feed 70 people a night, 100 people a night, and you've got to deliver a standard. And how do you do that? It's, in a way, you've got to make it foolproof. And it's very hard. And the way I did it was that I worked every day in my kitchen, behind my stove. I insisted on doing the work of 2 or 3 men. And a lot of the time, what would happen is that my cooks around me, they would, almost like a surgeon, they would pass me things, what I needed, and I would assemble it on the pass with my head chef. And then the people behind us were continuing to cook, et cetera, et cetera. And then we put the jigsaw together. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. What were some of the things that would just make you go off your nut, make you just completely explode in frustration at certain types of stupidity?
Well, in the latter years of my career as a chef, I never really shouted much in the end because I had an infrastructure around me. I had boys who'd been with me 10 years, 12 years, 15 years. But in those early days, when there was just myself and 2 or 3 young boys in the kitchen with me, I suppose it was my own frustrations. You can't blame that type of behavior on other people. You have to blame yourself.
Interesting, because so many people, you know, there's so many television shows now that show, purport to show life in the kitchen and as a pressure cooker. And it seems that the man at the top constantly exploding is just a part of that gestalt,
Well, I think what you see on TV is manufactured. I don't think it's real. It's when I watched Hell's Kitchen USA, I didn't see much food. I saw a lot of shouting. I didn't see much cooking by the man at the top. And I'm a great believer that you have to lead from the front. If you're going down in the kitchen, then go down with the boys. You have to be in the middle of it to get them out of that situation that they're in. You can't just stand there screaming, abusing, belittling people. It's not the way forward. Because in a kitchen, there's a lot of love. There's a lot of romance. Yeah, there's a lot of fun times. It's not just about shouting.
You were the first British chef to receive 3 Michelin stars, and you were really young. You were only 33. And then you ended up giving them all back.
I gave them back, you know, as I won them. I retained them for 5 years. And, you know, I was 38 years old. I used to leave home in the morning, and my children, they were sleeping in their beds. I kissed them goodbye. I'd come home in an evening. I'd kiss my children good evening, and they were sleeping. And I wasn't comfortable cooking 3 stars anymore, and I chased something that I never really truly wanted, if I'm really honest with myself. I sat there and I thought to myself, I've got really 3 options. My first option is to continue to work 6 days a week, not see my children, and be a prisoner of my world. My second option is to live a lie, pretend I cook, charge high prices, don't bother being behind my stove, question my integrity. My third option was to pluck up the courage from within and give back my stars. And that's what I did.
Wow. During these sort of halcyon days, when you were at the height of your first flush of early fame and you were still very much behind the stove, give us a sense of what it was like to be in the kitchen during a very pressured service.
Is I remember at the end of service that my jacket, I could have rinsed it. You know, I could have squeezed out extraordinary amounts of water. It used to stick to me during the service, and no one's ever asked me that question. What's it like? I don't know. It was a nightmare.
At the end of it, would you feel relieved, or did you feel dread that there was another one the next day?
No, I just drained, just numb. You know, it's on the back of the book, there's a photograph, and I look at that picture, and I just won my 2 stars in the Michelin. I don't even recognize myself. It's extraordinary. But it just shows you what hard work and pushing yourself to those extremes every day of the week does to you. And I just think to myself, was I mad? But we do what we do, and we have a reason for doing what we do. And I suppose my true reason for doing what I did was to build a monument for my mum. I think that's what's important. I think every boy should build a monument for his mum, and that's what I did.
So interesting speaking with you. Thank you.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
The Devil in the Kitchen, Sex, Pain, Madness, and the Making of a Great Chef is Marco Pierre White's latest book. Sign up for our weekly Good Food newsletter and find every week's show. You can stream Good Food, podcast Good Food, and watch episodes as well. Find it all on kcrw.com/goodfood. Good Food's executive producer is Jennifer Farrow. The show is produced by Thea Challoner, with Bob Carlson, Candace Moyer, Connie Alvarez, and Holly Tarson. The music supervisor is Gary Masiha. Special thanks to Beth Xavier. I'm Evan Kleiman. Join us next week for another edition of Good Food.